All right, 3, 2, 1. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, I have a very special guest, an author of fictional horror and other novels, but I was on his podcast, The Quiet Place, and his name is Zach Magaha. He's published on Amazon, and he has a book coming up that he's going to publish in July. But I was very curious kind of about the environment that he was in. I know that he had mentioned a name that I was familiar with through my research into True Detective, a name by an author who writes horror. His name is Thomas Ligotti, and I bought his book. It was Conspiracy Against the Human Race, which I read, a very grim book. But I was interested in Ligotti's influence on True Detective, but also kind of his worldview, and Zach's familiar with that as well. He's had some arguments with people online, so we're going to talk about that in detail. But Zach, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. Well, thanks for agreeing to the interview. The Quiet Place is on a YouTube stream, so people can check that out on YouTube. He does kind of long-form interviews, and we talked about the West Memphis 3 when I was on his show. But for people who don't know about the podcast or the YouTube stream, can you talk a little bit about yourself and how you became a writer of horror fiction, and just talk a little bit about your influences as well?
Yeah, I've been writing ever since I was, I want to say, a sophomore in high school. And I also started getting published then, too, because the first story I ever sent out actually sold to an anthology that's put out by Permuted Press back when the whole, I guess, the survival apocalypse zombie thing was going strong. But getting into fiction was mainly the result of first being in the movies and then realizing that the people who made the movies I wanted to make kind of started off with writing as they're like, you know, their influences, and some of them were writers on the side, like specifically David J. Scow, who was the screenwriter for the third Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. Mm-hmm. And up until that point, you know, I mean, I had read books as a kid, but wasn't like super into them. I wasn't a bookish kid, but finding out that I guess people doing cool things were also into books kind of like got me curious, and then books kind of became like the main thing for me after that. Like, it's pretty much all I do is read and write these days.
Gotcha. And how would you say you got involved in kind of the horror genre? What were you reading and what were your influences?
I have a lot of varied influences, or had a lot of varied influences early on that were mainly around the sphere of like out of print horror novels from like the 80s, 90s, and even, you know, back into the 70s. And it's kind of become like a kind of hipsterish thing now to be into the whole, I think they call it the paperbacks from hell craze, because there was a book that came out like detailing all that.
What was the title of that book? Do you recollect?
Yeah, Paperbacks from Hell.
Sorry.
Yeah. It was like a thing that covers like the whole 80s horror boom. So I was kind of like into that before the that book actually came out. So I was like the weird teenager who just had like a ton of like super old horror novels floating around. Just that was my main thing.
Were there any notable authors in that kind of 80s and 90s paperbacks from hell that people might know? Or are they all very obscure?
Most of them are obscure, but a lot of them have survived. Like I mentioned, David J. Scow. You know, all the splatterpunk authors like Craig Spector, John Skip, and a lot of the more obscure zebra writers like William W. Johnstone, Ruby Jean Jensen. Just not necessarily the best writers, but they were writing just really fun horror novels.
Gotcha. And how would you define splatter? What did you say, splatterpunk books?
Yeah, that's like the back when horror went from being kind of quiet, small-town horror to being, I guess, like more in-your-face and visceral, which that's not really what I'm into these days. That was just my initial interest when I was a teenager that got me into writing.
Gotcha. And what was the other... What's a zebra book? I don't know what that is.
Okay. That was a publisher that put out, like, a ton of the old paperbacks. Like, there were... I'm sure you probably remember... there was a time when, you know, you could go into bookstores and they had like the mass market racks full of just cover or books with like skeletons on the cover and whatnot. Yes. Of course, I wasn't around at that time, but I kind of like fell into that fake nostalgia. It's like I was meant for that time.
Well, it's interesting because that was definitely, I mean, it's interesting you talk about that because that's something I recollect. These were usually, these books were on these wire racks that you could just rotate around in a circle and just kind of pick something out that was cheap, almost kind of like a Pulp Fiction, but also just for horror, not necessarily like true crime or something in that kind of pulp genre, but definitely these horror books. You know, there was like a spy genre, a horror genre, and, you know, this kind of Pulp Fiction true crime genre. So it was those were back in the days, and the very cheap kind of books, you know, something like you know, you could buy it for, I mean, it depends upon the time, but in the 80s or 90s you could buy it, you know, $2, $3, $4, very cheap.
Yeah, most of them are, you know, as you said, cheap in content and what they cost back then. But when you're a teenager, it's kind of like, you know, just candy for you. I'm not really so much into those nowadays. I've kind of taken a more like snooty literary turn.
And what authors would typify that? When you say snooty, they're still within horror.
Not necessarily. I would say my favorite book of all time is The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann, the German author. So I'm more into like kind of the heavier literature these days, but I still, you know, read horror quite frequently. Like I'm reading House of Leaves right now, if you're familiar with that one.
I've heard that title, and I'm not familiar with the book. I have read a Thomas Mann novel, though. Like you say, Mann. It's spelled M-A-N-N. But, there was another book he wrote, which was, I read back in my college days, and it was like, it was a bit inscrutable. It was kind of a dense literary book. I didn't take a lot out of it. I don't recollect doing that. So you kind of came across that name I had mentioned in the intro, Ligotti. Can you tell the audience about this kind of little kerfluffle, this conflict that you had on social media about Ligotti?
Yeah, it was more funny than anything, but it was also kind of pathetic seeing people rush to his defense. Like, basically, there was a guy who runs a blog, a review blog that I used to write, you know, book reviews, movie reviews for. So I was acquainted with this guy. I haven't written anything on there for a long time, but I mean, I'm still friends with him. But he put out a thing on Facebook, like advert, you know, with a review that he had written for, I believe it was Thomas Ligotti's, I can't pronounce it,
Teatro Grotesco.
One of his, one of his collections of, I guess it was short stories. But I just innocently commented on there in jest because, I mean, I know the guy. And I'm like, I love Thomas Ligotti's fiction, but the real dude is this sad little goblin. And that was in reference, of course, to his kind of weirdly influential philosophy that is kind of adapted by a lot of, I call him the cosmic horror Illuminati because it's all these old people that, you know, love H.P. Lovecraft. Basically, they write H.P. Lovecraft fan fiction. And, of course, Thomas Ligotti's kind of in that sphere. He writes, I guess you'd say, vaguely Lovecraftian stories. And that one little comment poking fun at, you know, his kind of anti-natalist worldview got all these freaking authors just hammering me, coming onto my own page and writing things. You know, I'm sure you saw it. They just wouldn't
leave
me
alone. But yeah, the anti-natalism, sure, Schopenhauer, Ligotti, these people, like, I wish I was never born, that kind of attitude for people who haven't heard that term before. But yeah.
Yeah, this kind of also an obsession with suicide, because I'm sure you've read, I think, correct. Yeah, you said you read Conspiracy Against the Human Race, and, you know, he's kind of getting at suicide as, like, the logical end game of, like, a well-adjusted life, as morbid and weird as that sounds.
It's very bleak, super bleak, and that was kind of the influence that the writer for the True Detective wrote. So, because the intro, basically episode one, the character played by Matt McConaughey is Rustin Cole, and the guy who wrote it, there were some people called it plagiarism. I don't think he plagiarized it, but it's the exact, very similar quotes and phrases right out of Conspiracy Against the Human Race were put into True Detective, and people called the writer out on it, but it was more of like he was a creative, you know, where's that line between straight plagiarism and creative adaptation? I would say he creatively adapted a lot of Ligotti's statements into that show. And very bleak, you know, like this is, we're all just, you know, blips in time and all this stuff. So,
yeah, it's very morbid, depressing stuff. But the thing is, it's so easy to kind of overcome it once you can kind of see its flaws and realize you don't want to go down that path. And, you know, I'm kind of going at the stupid Facebook argument with almost the commonsensical take that it's like, you don't want to be aligned with that stuff, but people are kind of getting onto me like I'm like the bad guy for going after this dude's opinions. I mean, I'm not censoring his opinions. I'm just, you know, calling them what they are and calling him what he is, a sad little goblin. But it's like people can't take that in the horror community because in a roundabout way, it's almost like they worship that type of thing. They see it as a, you know, freedom of opinion thing. And of course, you know, Ligotti can say whatever he wants to, but they believe if you're taking a stance against that and then taking my stance, of course, which as a Christian would be the Christian response to that, they almost see that as like a form of bigotry that's going after the rebellious teenager in, you know, Ligotti's old, right. But
absolutely,
I'm sure you get where I'm going.
It was interesting because you had said in the pre-show that Ligotti did influence you, but in a contradictory sense, in the sense that you just didn't want to even have a part of that once you realized where that road of that bleak, depressed, hyper-depressive, you know, sterile worldview is, you know, just goes down that road. It's just incredible, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you could almost say it's satanic. I mean, I don't know if Ligotti is a Satan worshiper. I kind of doubt it because he seems super atheistic. But he is kind of worshiping in a roundabout way this death impulse and this almost rebelliousness against life. I mean, I guess that's why the book's called The Conspiracy Against the Human Race. But it did influence me actually from taking the step, whereas, you know, throughout my teenage years, and I'm now 22, I've basically been agnostic for most of my life, but that actually made me take the step into becoming like a full, you know, fledged baptized Christian, because I really, it kind of opened up a dichotomy in my mind where you're either aligned with that side, the evil kind of kill yourself, antinatalist side, to the Christian side, and there's not really an in-between, because if you, in my opinion, if you take atheism to its logical conclusion, Ligotti actually has a point, but it's just realizing that that's not the right side that you, A, it's not the side you want to be on, B, I think you could easily say it's not the right side.
That's interesting. And I think that a lot of those people who are admirers of Ligotti are in that same kind of vein, right? There's the antinatalist, and that might be something that is very common with these horror genre writers. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't agree with it. Like, I would say that there are some like that. For the most part, I believe they're kind of, I guess they would fall in that whole edgelord category. Like, they like his philosophy because it's bleak, dark, and cool and whatnot. I wouldn't say it's cool, but it's like they don't put that much thought into it. It's like they're just going for what's got this kind of aesthetic without really... They don't want the responsibility of taking a stance. They just like it because it's cool and it's an almost consumeristic type
that's
thing.
That's an interesting point. It's like a hipster edgelord. This is the way we think. This is our outlook. I mean, you feel like you've kind of passed through that. Would that be correct?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I kind of got that out of my system in high school. And
did you read any of his fiction?
No. Yeah, I've read a lot of his fiction, actually. In fact, I even did a... now, I wasn't a super fan. I did a little presentation and paper on him in an English class in college. So, I mean, I've read quite a bit of him. but I like his fiction. But once you know he's kind of operating from that worldview, it makes getting into it a little harder, because, you know, ultimately when you read fiction, you're kind of being introduced to the author's worldview and, I guess, spirit in a way, because you're kind of just aligning yourselves with their mental activity for that period of time. Ligotti's not someone you want to do that with, because he's obviously, you know, I would say obviously mentally ill, but then you could take it a step further and say, you know, in a roundabout way, pretty evil. Even if he sees himself as being right and innocent in that regard, he's kind of purposely
adopted that position. So you think, like, Conspiracy Against the Human Race is ostensibly nonfiction, so those ideas, I haven't read his fiction, but those ideas have permeated his horror fiction. Is that correct?
Yeah, and he does do it in a very, you know, get that across in a cool way. Like, it makes for a cool story. But again, it's all tying back to this kind of like Lovecraft fan fiction. Like,
yeah, because, I mean, Lovecraft is still there. He wrote a book, I think it's Red Brain, Great Tales of the Cthulhu Mythos. So he's kind of in that same spot of like Peter Lavenda too, who also wrote, I mean, ostensibly he's Simon, who wrote the Necronomicon, a work of fiction that's promoted as nonfiction in a way. And also, I mean, that guy was involved in rituals, occultism. You and I had talked offline, just for the audience sake, is that I recollect from my past research that Ligotti was in an OTO band or had some association. I can't find the reference. I've got to look into that, but I vaguely remember coming across that years ago, you know, 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me, because, like, they're, well, the majority of horror people are pretty normal. There's definitely a subset of, I guess, kind of occult-obsessed people. Like, for instance, when I was 16, I went to this thing called the Borderlands Press Writers Boot Camp, which was basically a thing put on by these, I guess, more famous horror authors. Like, they kind of teach up-and-coming writers, like, you know, the craft and how to sell and all that stuff. And I ran into two people there. One is an OTO member, or was an OTO member, and another one is more of a, I guess, more well-known occultist these days. He has a lot of ritual magic books out, one from freaking that lame Falcon publisher. What is Falcon? It? The Moon? Llewellyn.
Do you recollect his name?
Yeah, his name was Michael Hughes. I got into another... Back when I had my old Facebook account, I had gotten into a kerfluffle with him over... back when Alex Jones got kicked off pretty much everything, I'd like... put something up there about like how he shouldn't have been kicked off, and then that freaking drove him crazy, and we had a falling out over that. The OTO member, I don't want to mention his name because he's not like famous or anything. Understand.
So Michael Hughes is definitely in that. So he's writing fictional horror as well as magical books. Is that correct? Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, it's also kind of like, you know, somebody who I've researched a lot about is somebody who liked horror films and The Exorcist and all that was Damien Eccles, but also writes magic books. So it's interesting how that is.
Yeah, that's so weird to me, because it's like all these kind of occultic things, like in the context of the horror movies, it's not really, they're not good things. It's not promoting horror, promoting the evil per se. I just don't get how someone could walk away from seeing The Exorcist and be like, I want to get involved with freaking demons or something. Like, I just don't get it.
That was the name of that demon. Michael Hughes' book, one of them is Magic for the Resistance, Rituals and Spells for Chains. No, that's a literal title. Magic for the Resistance, published in 2018. Llewellyn Publications. There you go. Just like you said.
Yeah. I haven't talked about that.
That's interesting. And he's got some... Lon Milo Duquette wrote a little blurb for the book, and I wrote about Lon Milo Duquette in Children of the Beast as somebody who got his OTO introduction by a guy who literally knew Crowley. So that line is still there. Lon Milo Duquette, it was Grady McMurtry who literally sat at the foot of Crowley. So it's pretty remarkable. That guy's still around, too. I saw Lon Milo Duquette was on a couple podcasts recently. So I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah, we're talking about, like, I guess the worst example of the fiction community. Okay, well, not everyone's like that.
So Llewellyn, what's your opinion of Llewellyn as a publisher? I wasn't as familiar with that.
I don't like any type of occult publisher. I mean, just, you know, for obvious religious reasons. But they seem like really, I guess, trendy. Like I think they started that whole freaking Wiccan craze in a roundabout way, if I remember correctly. I'm not 100% about that, but they've obviously milked it.
Well, their symbol is a half moon, so that's somewhat telling. This guy, Michael Hughes, is the creator of the internationally viral spell to bind Donald Trump and all those who abet him, the largest magical working in history. Oh boy. So anyway, you've had some interesting associations, no doubt. So, what else?
Yeah, that's kind of why I stand out in the freaking fiction community, because there are, I'm sure, Christians in the Christian community, but there aren't, I guess they're either quiet about it, or they just, you know, they're not like me. They're not going to get on, like a platform and voice their opinions. They're just going to stay out of it. But
yeah, I mean, I guess that's one of the good things, upsides of social media, is you can actually confront some of these people on that you couldn't do otherwise. I mean, for whatever the downsides are, at least you can see what they're saying in real time. But what else is there to cover? I mean, you have a book coming up soon, is that correct?
Yeah, I've got one coming out from a very tiny publisher called Nihilism Revised. I don't know if they have a website yet. I think their only like internet presence is probably their Facebook page. But they've my book coming out is called Dinosaurs and Potted Plants, and it's like a vacation beach trip type of novel. It's more inspired by like comedy than anything, but it's probably my favorite thing I've written. It also has sort of a spiritual side to it, because I wrote it like right before I became a Christian, so it does have sort of like a spiritual journey thing coming on, but I wouldn't put it in like religious.
When you publish it,
are you gonna,
and when it's on Amazon, what genre will it be published in?
I don't know, because it might just show up in the literary genre. It might show up in the bizarro genre, because the book I have out now, Soothing the Savage Swamp Beast, was published by Bizarro Pulp Press, and bizarro is like a tiny, like, little genre. I guess it does have its own identifier on Amazon, I'm not sure, but it'll probably show up in that sphere.
And that's July? That's when you're going to publish that?
Gotcha. Yeah, that's when they're putting it out. Maybe earlier, it just depends, because it's one dude running the publisher, so if he gets to it a little quicker.
And what else? I mean, where can people reach out to you if they're interested in talking about your literary endeavors?
Two places. Of course, my Facebook page, which is just Zach McGah. And then the YouTube stream I do that you were on, called The Quiet Place. Now, it's not that I didn't create it. I was asked to be, like, you know, co-host on it. But it's called The Quiet Place, but our old YouTube account actually got deleted, so we've had to put everything else back up. The show is still called The Quiet Place, but the YouTube account is called Hatchet Mouth.
Gotcha. Hatchet spelled H-A-T-C-H-E-T mouth, right? And your name is, Zach, Z-A-K, McGaha's M-C-G-A-H-A, just for people. I got you.
Yeah. Yeah. But then my books are under Zachary, of course. Like, I tried that, too. Like, if you just put in Zach McGahey on Amazon,
I actually had a little difficulty searching for you. And what kind of topics are you covering on your podcast? Or your YouTube stream, I should say.
Oh, we just talk about everything. Multiple subjects. Like, some of them go, like, 8 hours long. Like, they're pretty crazy. I guess mainly you would say it's a book-oriented podcast because we're all either writers or readers, mm-hmm. like, you know, the regulars on it. But we get into everything from culture to religion. Really everything.
Sorry,
everything from the West. I was just about to say everything from the West Memphis 3 where we had you on to our last guest was... We've had so many, I'm actually blanking on who the last guest was. I think he was another indie author. This coming week, we're supposed to have a guy on who's like one of those, COVID whistleblowers, like a medical personnel dude who believes we're overreacting or something like that, which hopefully won't get us kicked off
right.
YouTube.
Well,
for
that's
the second
what they're
time,
saying. But. The head of YouTube flat out said that if the information contradicts what the WHO says, it's considered misinformation. It could be kicked off. So you got to watch out.
Yeah, that makes me mad, though, that they would say that, considering have you seen the recent news where the WHO had some kind of I don't even know what it was, but it was some kind of report, and they're advocating teaching very young children to like
oh, no, really creepy. No, they blew it. Like, I mean, they actually are getting financed by the Chinese, so they had a kind of financial issue involved with the very beginning or inception of where this virus came out. And they said, I think they published something in January where they said there was no human-to-human transmission, so that's a flat-out lie. So that's the World Health Organization. That's why they got in part defunded. I mean, I think Trump made a smart decision and defunded them because it's a institution that's not objective. It's not. It's corrupt, in my opinion. So I don't think the CDC is that much better. Actually, Centers for Disease Control bungled and dropped the ball on this whole thing from the get-go, and that's our own administrative body institution. So now, don't get me started with a lot of that stuff. Holy smokes! I mean, do you feel like the whole COVID situation is affecting you in Tennessee?
I will say I've not been a fan of the isolation because, you know, I live in a rural area and it's just like, you know, I guess I was used to that being part of, you know, my main human contact. You know, I'm a college student, so, you know, I was living in the dorms and
oh, so they,
now
they had
I'm
to
like,
shut you,
know,
shut you
back
out
home.
The dorms on, send you home. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like you get sent home and then you can't freaking leave and go
right.
do anything.
So, I mean, we're at like just, what now? 45 days, 60 days, depending upon where you're at. March 15th?
Yeah. Luckily in Tennessee, it's actually things are being lifted. Like I've actually, you know, several restaurants are opened up. They're starting to open the state parks and national parks back up.
Well, here in L.A., so, I mean, I was on the freeway just yesterday, and it kind of felt like it was getting back to normal, whether or not the governor is really going to enforce that. But people are definitely chomping at the bit to get out and get back to doing stuff. But everybody's wearing a mask, which I think is prudent. So, as far as I'm...
Yeah. Now, one question I have for you, because I've always, you know, I've been into your stuff, like the documentaries and books and all that. How do you live in L.A. and, like, you know, because you're against all this occultic degeneracy. And it's like you live, like, right in the heart of it. Like, have you ever brushes against people?
I mean, the thing is that, you know, I have mixed. But I live kind of, like, in a smaller place in the south area of L.A. that's more of a beach town. So I would say that the whole huge megalopolis of Los Angeles is broken in to different parts, and the parts that I live in, not too many people are involved in the entertainment world. You know, they're just kind of normal day-to-day people with, you know, your standard job. So I don't really live in a, like the Hollywood Hills, or I'm not in the entertainment industry and never was, so I don't kind of mix with some of the people I critique. But I've had some interesting moments for sure. But, you know, I would say that I really wasn't a public criticism. You know, it's probably only been 10 years. My first book was Prophet of Evil was published in 2010, so it's only really been 10 years. And I'm not a very public person. Definitely like my privacy. So it's been, I mean, I could tell you stories offline that I'll probably think are pretty funny. But, yeah, no, it's been interesting. I mean, like I said, you know, some people who don't live in LA may see the city as one giant contiguous thing. It's not. It's made up of different counties and different cities. Kind of probably like New York, where, you know, you could drive 45 minutes outside of New York City and be in a completely different environment. I think LA is a lot like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's like, you know, I can walk down to the beach. I live very close to the beach, which makes it nice. So
yeah, that will
yeah,
be
so
cool.
Is there anything else we missed, Zach? Anything you'd like to add? Anything you'd like to promote? Anything?
Yeah, I guess I'd like to promote the only book I have in print right now, which is Soothing the Savage Swamp Beast, which is like kind of a, I would call it a literary comedy. It's kind of marketed as like a bizarro horror type thing because it's put out by Journalstone, which is a, you know, they basically just publish horror fiction. But yeah, it's the only book I have out right now because my two horror novels that had been put out through a publisher in the UK called Kensington Gore Publishing, those novels were Hospitalized, Factory of Pain, and Locker Arms. Like, they're kind of weird horror comedies. They were just axed completely off Amazon because the publisher had put a book out like 3 years ago and it somehow got flagged. I don't know what book it was or why it got flagged, but Amazon's decision was to completely, like, basically delete their Kindle direct publishing account, which is, you know, how they publish their books. You know, you go through that and then it's basically an, you know, it provides the ebook and then it's like a paperback printer. So they deleted that. So me, my books and like 100, I think over 100 authors or over 100 books at least got just, you know, deleted. Wow. For good in like a second. Like the only way you can get, I don't even know if you can get Locker Arms anymore. I'm selling my last copy of Hospitalized Factory of Pain on Amazon, or not Amazon, eBay. I did have two copies of it. One of them sold, so basically the last copy of that book's on eBay now for like $15 or 15, not 50 bucks.
So what are all these authors, right, including now, you, trying to going to do to try to get the rights back from the publisher so that you can either self-publish or try to get those books back out in circulation?
Well, the rights do revert back to us, so I'm fine on that part. However, I'm kind of just going to let those books die. Not that I'm not proud of them, because they are, they're not like the books I had published in high school where I got the publisher to take them out of print because, you know, it was my high school writing, and looking at it now, it seemed kind of amateurish. These two books I am very proud of, but they're more on like the, I guess you'd say, not really extreme horror side, but they're not, I guess, you know, there's a lot of blood, sex, and stuff. And being a recently converted Christian from like, I think it was November of 2019, I felt kind of weird having those books that had all that stuff, you know, in it out there. And it just didn't really jive with the new direction with my writing because, like I said, even Soothing the Savage Swamp Beast, which is out now, isn't really a horror novel. And horror isn't my main thing writing-wise. Like, I really don't produce that much horror. So I'm kind of just letting
the
old
horror. So where do you think you're headed as far as your, you know, literary aspirations are?
Um, Like I said, I've got that one book coming out in July. I'm about maybe halfway through, close to halfway through another novel right now, which is another kind of a, I guess you would just call it literary comedy. Not so much a comedy per se as like a lighthearted literary type thing. And aside from that, I'm just, you know, I'm always writing something. I don't really know what, I mean, I'm constantly creating stuff, but I don't really know like what I want like out of a career. I don't know if careers in fiction are actually viable these days just because the industry is so crazy. And yes, also it's so political because, you know, I've never self-published. I've always been published by traditional small presses. And even in the small press world, things are very political. If you're right-wing, you're ostracized. And I'm right-wing and vocal about Christianity, so I'm definitely ostracized for that.
Well, my
so self-publishing may be in my future. I'd see that as more of like a liberating, like, freedom type thing. Like, I know it's kind of probably still looked down upon
and
a little bit.
I don't think that that's really fair because in my experience, I was a person who, just to let you know, like, my experience was, you know, going to publishers and being told you're going to get 10% of, you know, net, you're going to get a very small fee and have no control. I'm going to own your stuff. And for me, it was total control, total, you know, I can upload and re-upload. I can make revisions. I'm actually working on fixing typos from an old manuscript. Plus, you know, you end up with 70% of the proceeds. So you get to see the results of your work. You kind of see what people like. And you get automatic daily or monthly ledgers showing what you people have bought. So for me, my experience of self-publishing was much more positive than you know, letting somebody own my manuscript or have control over it. So
yeah, plus you can be way faster about it because I mean I'm a fast writer.
Hey man, I got to tell you, it's super easy.
And
I mean, once you figure out Amazon Kindle, because once it goes on Amazon, you can kind of just extrapolate it to everybody else. Amazon obviously has huge reach globally. But, you know, you look at, I would recommend that to you, man. Try it out. Definitely recommend that.
Yeah, that's probably what I'm going to do for the novel I'm finishing up.
Well, Zach,
now
we are at 40 minutes. Anything else? Anything else that you want to add before we wrap this up?
Yeah, one thing I would like you to add, I want you to explain to my podcast co-host, Jeremy Maddox, why he is wrong about the Alford plea.
Okay, it's a Supreme Court case, right? So the Alford plea references Alford versus North Carolina. And it was the Supreme Court's conclusion was that the party could still publicly say they were innocent, but it's still a guilty plea. So they were allowed to exercise their freedom of speech to say, I'm not guilty, but I'm going to sign guilty. So legally at law, it's a guilty plea. Alford, not Alfred, is a guilty plea, and that's what the West Memphis 3 took in August 2011. So they're guilty at law until 2021, their probation ends, but they always have a guilty plea on, and it's really that simple. I mean, you can just type into Google Alfred v. North Carolina and get the Supreme Court opinion. It's very easy to read. These days, it's just the internet has expedited so many of these Supreme Court cases where you can just get a little blurb that distills, you know, the court and the breakdown of opinion and all that stuff. So it's not that hard to figure out. And I think, you know, the one of the things about the West Memphis 3 is that I don't know, I can't think of any other court case. Well, there might be maybe the Central Park 5 where there's been so much deliberate obfuscation, misinformation and disinformation and PR stuff that you know, obfuscates the actual record. So you know, it's unique in that regard. But yeah, Alford's very easy. You just do a little legwork and you'll figure it out, you know. But I, you know, I think that that's really the hard part of the West Memphis 3 is to parse through and separate the PR from actual evidence and facts. I think that's really vital to come to a conclusion of that, because when I first read the when I first was looking into the West Memphis 3, I thought they were let out on a technicality. So that's what I thought. So I was like, oh, man. And I actually didn't really even start researching it maybe 2012. So I just remember hearing something in the news and just going, oh, there must have been something amiss, you know. And then I started researching, and it's like, hold on, this is a guilty plea. Hold on, they just admitted that there's enough evidence to convict them. Oh, they just signed that with the best attorneys. And then I realized there was a lot of misinformation that actually, I think that they were very clever in bullhorning that. And really, I think that the PR people were very clever. So, anyway. And you can read about that in my book, Abomination, Devil Worship and Deception. So there's a lot of deception in that whole case. And you got to ask yourself why there is, you know. I think that's important. And we talked about the OTO, Damian Echols, and that's in my book. It was a member of the Arkansas OTO while he was in jail. So that's a stated fact from the OTO's own records, actually. Yeah. Crazy, man. So just to wrap up, it's Zach Magaha. You can find his work on Amazon. He has an upcoming book. The YouTube stream that he does is The Quiet Place, long-form discussions, literary reference, you know, kind of literary bent on it or literary take on things. And
That's Hatchet, a hatchet right, mouth, sorry. The YouTube.
Account. So if people want to check that out, please go check that out. And you can listen to me talk about the West Memphis 3, like a month ago maybe?
It seems like it's been a little longer.
Sometime a couple months ago, we talked about it. So anyway, Zach McGaha, thanks so much.
You're welcome.